Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services has established the new 988 Lifeline to improve both accessibility of crisis services and to meet growing suicide and mental health-related crisis care needs. We'll hear more from Doug Jackson, administrator of the program. Poison hemlock is on the increase around the state and can be very dangerous. Jay Fox speaks with Sarah Schott from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources about what to be on the lookout for and what to do if exposure occurs. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, the 988 Lifeline was established to improve both accessibility of crisis services and to meet the nation's growing suicide and mental health-related crisis care needs. Technically speaking, 988 is not new. It's built on the foundation of the former 10-digit National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. However, this new, easier-to-remember three-digit number provides 24/7 free and confidential support to Ohioans experiencing a behavioral health crisis, thoughts of suicide, mental health or substance use crisis, or any kind of emotional distress. Here in Ohio, the 988 Lifeline number is administered by the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And we're thrilled to be joined today by Doug Jackson. He is the 988 administrator for the state of Ohio. Doug, thank you for joining us on Columbus Perspective.
Great to be with you, Kate. I'm excited to talk about 988.
Now, in my brief intro, I kind of explained what the 988 number exists to do. But to further go into more detail on that, when should someone say, this might be time, and I'm saying to call, but if I'm not mistaken, we can also text 988, correct?
Yeah, there's actually three different ways that people can reach out to 988. It's call, chat, or text. So the call and text is both through a cell phone, a telephone, very easy to use. The chat function would be through a web browser. So it's not difficult either, but with today's technology, we want to make it available any way that a person chooses to reach out.
And when should someone say, I think I need to reach out for this help?
Yeah, that's a great question, because oftentimes people just keep things inside. They keep it to themselves. We like to point out that, you know, the answer to the question, how are you doing? People will say, I'm fine. And really behind that is kind of an asterisk. It's there, a qualifying statement that if you ask the person on a personal level, how are you really doing? There might be a much longer story that's there. And so we want people to reach out whenever they believe that they need to talk. That could be a crisis. It could just be for support that they need or to talk through an issue that they're having.
I've been very fond of saying in the past few years that if there is a positive aspect to the pandemic, I believe that it has given us license and freedom and comfort to talk more frankly and openly about mental health issues specifically. And this seems to be something, whereas the need is there, as I said, a growing mental health and suicide crisis in our nation. At least now we are having conversations that weren't had as out loud before. Is that something that you and your profession are finding as well, Doug?
Yeah, we have many efforts going towards that from the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Really, it's about reducing the stigma of mental health, or, you know, telling people it's okay to not be okay. So we want to just let people open up and share what they need to share, and do that confidentially. And that's what 988 can allow, is that person that can listen, empathetic listeners, but also if additional supports are needed, this trained mental health professional can help to work the person through de-escalation, ensure that they're safe, and even connect them to local mental health supports if needed.
How is 988 different than 911?
911 has been around for a long time, and our whole country has really become familiar with 911. And 911 dispatches police, fire, ambulance. They really respond to people's physical health emergencies. 988 is really focused on mental health. So when we're talking to somebody that has contacted 988, we're just helping them through that time in their life. It might be a dark time. It might just be, like I said earlier, a need to talk to somebody. But oftentimes you aren't going to open up and share some of the things you might share when you contact 988. Share that same level of information with somebody who's a coworker or family or friend, because you just need that confidential lifeline.
We're talking with Doug Jackson. He is the 988 administrator for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. They have undertaken a pretty aggressive statewide awareness campaign of the 988 lifeline number. Doug, what would you say are some of the goals of the statewide awareness campaign?
You know, we want all Ohioans to know what 988 is, just begin to understand it, know that it's a resource, and as people use it, also trust that that number is going to provide the support that it needs to those who are contacting it. When you compare it to 911, as we were talking about just moments ago, it took a long time for 911 to become the go-to number to get police, fire, and ambulance. For those of us that remember back in the day of having a sticker on your telephone, and that telephone had a cord going to the wall, and that sticker had 7-digit numbers on it that connected you to your local police, fire, and ambulance separately. 988 is a 3-digit number, just like 911 is. It is easy to remember. It's a go-to number, but people have to become aware of it first. And so that's what our awareness campaign is all about.
Now, before launching the awareness campaign for 988, your department actually increased the number of call centers and sort of made a very robust menu of resources that are available to people here in Ohio, right?
We did. So the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline already had call centers in Ohio. Those call centers were small and funded from a national level with a very little amount of money, but it was a great resource to start with. It was a backbone that 988 was able to create or build upon. So 988, we took it from 12 call centers that existed in Ohio under the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We increased it to 19 call centers. We made sure that there was coverage for all Ohioans. And we really worked with the staff that answer these calls to ensure that they were trained with the same level of training across the state, that we had the capacity to answer the increasing volume of calls, and that we could answer those calls quickly.
Pretty quickly, in fact. 25 seconds is your average answer rate, and that surpasses the national average. And nearly all of the calls that originate here are answered in state. Only about 1% have to roll over to the backup, but it's a very, it seems, comprehensive and a very well thought out system of support. Also, I think it's important to mention there's specialized staff on board and ready at the Ohio 988 Lifeline number to assist Ohioans that speak Spanish. If you request specific support for LGBTQ+ issues, veterans' needs, which are different than other people's. Also, they have provisions made if you use American Sign Language or someone you know does for their primary mode of communication and need video phone. These are all accommodated by the Ohio 988 Lifeline. It really is an amazing resource. Like we've been discussing, so much more talk, which is ultimately a positive thing about mental health in our society. I think sometimes, though, people get overwhelmed and aren't expecting I may need mental health support and then might even find themselves approaching or in crisis. Well, it's not like you have a therapist on hand that you've already established a relationship with a 988. Someone could immediately talk to a trained professional that, like you said, Doug, can help de-escalate and then eventually refer a person who may be in mental health crisis, who may be considering suicide or self-harm, can then be referred to resources after that call to help them continue a journey to a healthier mental outlook, right?
Yeah, you described that very well. And really what we want people to know is you might not be in crisis today, but any day can bring around events that could create crisis in your life. 988 is not just for a group of people that may have a history of mental illness. 988 is a resource for those times in people's lives that come as a surprise and can be overwhelming. also a resource for those who have mental health conditions that have been part of their life for a long period of time. So it serves all of those needs when it comes to mental and behavioral health.
Is there anything else that we haven't discussed yet about the 988 Lifeline that you want to make sure that we hear about today, Doug?
Well, I think that today's conversation is part of our goal of just having more people be aware. So we did some research as we began our marketing to understand how many Ohioans already knew what 988 was. We found about 36% of Ohioans, so just over a third of Ohioans knew about 988. But that means that two-thirds of Ohioans did not know that 988 was a resource for them. And so our goal is lofty. We want to increase that awareness, and we have plenty of opportunity to do that. And it's through these conversations. So your listeners today, when they hear about 988, hopefully they have a conversation on the dinner table or at their workplace to say, hey, have you heard of 988? We had to maybe do something to make more people aware of it within our family, within our workplace, and really just increase awareness so that more people are safe.
Crisis looks very different from one person to the next, and that's why the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services encourages any Ohioan experiencing a mental health or addiction crisis or a family member, close friend, loved one to call, text, or chat with the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline to reach a trained specialist who is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to offer that help and support. Doug Jackson, I thank you so much for your time today in joining us here on Columbus Perspective.
Well, we appreciate your help in helping us make more people aware of 988.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Joining us today is Sarah Schott, who is the Wildlife Communications Specialist with the Ohio Division of Wildlife. We welcome her to Columbus Perspective to talk about a plant called the poison hemlock. Sarah, how are you today?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day outside, so it's always a great day.
Where will we find poison hemlock?
Yes, so poison hemlock is something that we commonly see in areas that have disturbance. So if you're driving down the road, you'll often see that along the roadside, in ditches. Sometimes if there's an area that used to be forested that got opened up for whatever reason, you might see that it grows up there. They really like an area that has had disturbance where they can get adequate sunlight. And so that's usually where we see them. This plant is really common in central and western Ohio, but it can be found in all 88 counties across the state. And it's important to note that this plant is not a native plant to Ohio. This is an invasive plant that was brought here from the other side of the world, so we don't necessarily want to have it here.
So the question then becomes, how do you identify poison hemlock visually?
Yes, so it's a very tall plant. So once you can pick out that tall plant with those white flowers, you'll probably end up seeing it everywhere. But it's a very tall plant, can grow up to 10 feet tall, and it has these small clusters of white flowers. Now, a lot of people, when they think of a tall plant with small white clusters of flowers, they think of Queen Anne's lace, which is a native plant. It also goes by the name of wild carrot. That is a very good plant to have. So easy to get it confused with that, but we are looking for a tall plant, small clusters of white flowers, and then a stem that is smooth, so it doesn't have a hairy stem. And that stem, one of the most key identifying factors is this reddish, purplish spots and streaks on the stem. They're pretty easy to see from a good distance. You don't have to get too close, but those are really identifying characteristic that we're looking for. They also have leaves that look kind of fern-like. So you're looking for leaves that have some toothing or some cuts in them.
When you talk about the flowers and the confusion perhaps with Queen Anne's lace, do the flowers look the same or do they have a different shape and texture?
Yes, so they do look really similar, especially at first glance. They both have that tight cluster of small white flowers. But Queen Anne's lace is a little bit more tightly clustered, and they almost form like a small dish or a cup. And if you're looking really closely at that flower, Queen Anne's lace has one small purplish, dark reddish dot in the middle of that cluster of white flowers. It's actually where its name comes from. So you'll see a small, tight cluster of white flowers and a purple dot in the middle. That is the Queen Anne's lace. Now, this poison hemlock does not have that purple dot. And even though it has those small white clusters of flowers, they're a little bit looser. It doesn't necessarily make this cup or dish shape.
So when we talk about the effect that the plant has on humans, how deadly is it?
Yes. So it can be a deadly plant. It's one plant that we have here in Ohio that can cause severe harm. It's important to remember that this is only when it's ingested. So a lot of people are thinking that poison hemlock is like poison ivy, where we touch it, we could get a really bad rash. Not necessarily the case with poison hemlock. For a good thing, it's something that if you ingest it. So when we're talking about poisonous things, that's something that we would eat and it would cause us harm. So poison hemlock, when you ingest that plant, it can be deadly. It can put you in the hospital, can cause a lot of severe reactions to that plant. And it's really important to know that just the smallest amount of poison hemlock can be extremely dangerous. So we want to make sure we're avoiding that. But on the good news, on the good side, just accidentally touching that plant or brushing up against it, it's very unlikely that you're going to get some sort of rash. There are exceptions. If you have extremely sensitive skin, you might get develop some sort of rash. And then in even rarer situations, if you have some sort of cut on your arm, it is possible for those toxins to enter the bloodstream through a cut on your arm. So it's always just best to avoid the plant as much as possible. But if you do accidentally brush up against it, usually there's nothing to worry about. It's when we accidentally ingest that plant or somehow it ends up in our system that we really need to be concerned. And in that case, it can be very deadly to both people and animals.
So this may be a silly question, but do people eat Queen Anne's lace?
Yeah, so Queen Anne's lace is an edible plant. Obviously, whenever you're eating any wild plant, you want to be extremely confident in what you are identifying. So if you are going to try to eat Queen Anne's lace, be very careful. Make sure you're not eating poison hemlock. Always look for that purple, small purple dot in the middle of the flower. That is a dead giveaway that you're looking at Queen Anne's lace or wild carrot. But it is different from our poison hemlock in that it is not deadly. It doesn't have quite a unique flavor. So unless you're really just looking to try something new, nothing super special there that you're missing out on.
So given that it is a wild plant, does this have an impact on wildlife like deer or raccoons or foxes or even dogs? Is there the possibility that they could ingest it and also get sick?
Sure, yes. And that is a concern in our livestock field. People who have cattle or sheep or goats, every now and then they will accidentally ingest that poison hemlock and it can cause issues for them. I would imagine the same thing could possibly happen with our wildlife just because they're out there interacting with these plants. But the good thing is that with our wildlife, especially, and with our livestock, with our pets or dogs, this isn't a plant that they're seeking out to try to eat. They have learned through life experiences, just the way the world works, that this isn't a good plant to eat. It doesn't have a great taste to them regardless. So normally, especially when we're talking about livestock, if they have other grazing options, they're going to graze on other types of grasses or things that they're more familiar with first. It's only if they become they're overgrazing an area, which happens in a rare situation where they don't have readily access food available, that they might go and eat poison hemlock and then get sick from that. But this usually doesn't happen very often, which is a very good thing. But some dogs, they like to munch on grass and plants and things like that. So if you do have poison hemlock in your yard or a place that you normally walk, just make sure you're keeping your dog on a leash or calling it away from that area just in case. You never know. You don't want them to accidentally ingest that plant and then have to take them to the vet or anything like that.
So on the just in case that as a human, I'm exposed and I ingest this, what is the treatment?
So when we're treating poison hemlock, we are not necessarily treating ingesting the poison hemlock directly. We are treating the symptoms that you're experiencing. So that could be a fever, that could be vomiting, that could be nausea, rashes, whatever that might be, that is what is being treated. We are treating the symptoms when that is done. So when you go to a hospital or a doctor, they're going to treat the symptoms for you. And it's very important that if you think you've eaten poison hemlock and you are feeling out of sorts for whatever reason, call a doctor, get to an urgent care, a hospital as soon as possible. That way they can make sure that the situation doesn't get any worse, such as giving you fluids or anything like that that you might need. If it's possible, you know, don't break off the plant and take it with you. We don't want to expose anybody else to this plant, right? But maybe if there's somebody with you or you yourself can snap a picture of that plant and take that with you to whatever medical attention that you're receiving, that can always be helpful so that they can better understand that it's probably poison hemlock we're experiencing. But if you think that you have ingested poison hemlock, get to a sort of medical professional as soon as possible.
All right. We've been talking with Sarah Schott, who's a wildlife communication specialist with the Ohio Division of Wildlife. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
A long fight to get President Joe Biden on Ohio's ballot is now over. The Democratic National Committee is getting around relying on state lawmakers altogether by nominating their 2024 presidential candidate virtually. This is something we've been following closely for the past several months when Secretary of State Frank LaRose first warned Democrats about the deadline issue. It also rounded this year's Democratic National Convention, which is set to happen days after Ohio's August 7th deadline to certify the ballot. That meant the convention had to either move up or state lawmakers had to pass an exception for Biden, delaying the deadline. Lawmakers worked on a legislative fix in a special session called by Governor Mike DeWine. But the DNC decided to take a different approach. By holding a virtual roll call vote, they're able to nominate Biden before the Ohio deadline without worrying about other options. In a statement, Democratic National Committee Chair Jamie Harrison says, quote, "Through a virtual roll call, we will ensure that Republicans can't chip away at our democracy through incompetence or partisan tricks, and that Ohioans can exercise their right to vote for the presidential candidate of their choice." Lieutenant Governor John Husted is also weighing in on the recent effort to get President Biden on the ballot. He says everyone deserves to have both candidates on the ballot, but thinks it's already clear who will win in Ohio in November.
I'm confident that Donald Trump is going to trounce Joe Biden in this election. But I want to make sure that it's fair. We want everybody to have a chance to make their voice heard for their preferable candidate. And Governor DeWine is going to make sure that that's the case.
Meantime, another major development in the race for the White House. A jury found former President Trump guilty on all 34 counts in his hush money criminal trial. Trump was charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records in a scheme to illegally influence the 2016 election. He was accused of using hush money payments to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Trump becomes the first former president to be convicted of felony crimes. He faces possible prison time when he is sentenced on July 11th. That is just 4 days before the Republican National Convention. Trump is expected to quickly appeal that guilty verdict. Well, there's a lot to break down in these big developments in the race for president. So let's bring in our expert right now, University of Cincinnati political science professor David Niven. David, thanks again for being here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Well, first of all, just, you know, starting with former President Trump's situation, what do you make of, you know, a former president actually being convicted of felony crimes?
Well, the one word that goes along with everything Trump is unprecedented. You know, The nature of his campaign in 2016 was unprecedented. The nature of the presidency, unprecedented. The nature of the weeks following the election of 2020, unprecedented. So, you know, this is the culmination. Obviously, he has four different, you know, criminal cases against him right now. This was the first to make it inside a courtroom, and this was the first to produce a conviction.
And it's the state one, and the others are federal, I believe. So what does this mean, though, for his campaign going forward?
Well, I think the biggest thing this has meant to this moment is it's interrupted his ability to control the conversation. He runs a campaign very much on the notion that he can decide what the topic of the day is. And this has really brought him down in terms of his ability to shape conversations. He's been, you know, he's been on the receiving end of a, you know, of a topic chosen and imposed on him. You know, his typical supporter, you know, sees him in a way that he can do no wrong. So this is going to reinforce that base who's going to see him.
That he's under attack,
that he's a victim, that he's their victim. Certainly that's how he's going to portray himself. But here's the problem for him. Every state primary, there's been significant votes for Nikki Haley, even when she dropped out. Those are Republicans who are not entirely comfortable with Trump. And a 34 times convicted Trump is not more appealing to those Haley voters who he needs in November.
That was going to be my next question was the base will stick with him.
Right.
We're seeing people doubling down and putting their support behind him. But it is those voters who are maybe unsure of which way to go. Haven't made up their minds yet, whether they voted for him in the past or not.
Well, those voters who are unsure, those voters who have Trump fatigue, those voters who, you know, maybe thinking about the practical realities, because this is one conviction. It's not the last court case. This is not the last time he's going to sit before a judge and jury in all likelihood. So, you know, the practical realities of a presidential candidate who is facing sentencing, as you mentioned, in July.
Just 4 days before the Republican National Convention. Does the campaign also and its impact on the convention depend on that sentence that comes down? Because they talk about there's a chance for prison time, but it's highly unlikely.
I mean, the range of possible sentences is everything from probation to home confinement to prison. You know, I think typically in New York, a case like this is a rather minor penalty, but typically you don't have 34 counts. You know, you don't have the guilty on 34 different counts.
How does President Biden address this?
I think the opportunity for President Biden is to really tell the story of what he's been working on and to really do, in effect, for America, a split screen. You know, while Donald Trump is over here, you know, worrying about prison time, I'm building bridges. You know, while Donald Trump is in here dealing with judges and juries, you know, I'm producing, you know, I'm going to work every day. And really, he doesn't need to talk about this. Everybody knows about it. You know, he doesn't need, you know, normally in a campaign, you know, you have to hype certain things, make sure people are thinking about it. Well, they're already thinking about that. So he really needs to present the contrast.
Switching now to the ballot issue here in Ohio. What's your perspective on the DNC making this move? You and I had talked about it a month or so ago, making the move to a virtual roll call before the in-person convention to make sure the president is going to be on Ohio's ballot.
Right. Well, the number one thing is this is something the Democratic Party can control. They couldn't control the timing of the Ohio legislature. They couldn't control, you know, a potential court case. This is the one thing in their control. So it makes sense they made this move. And, you know, you can kind of think of it as, you know, that part of the Oscars where they hand out the awards that isn't on television. You know, this is going to be the part of the convention where they do the actual important thing, even though it's not going to be formally part of the convention. It's going to happen in advance.
Do you think that this upsets delegates in the 49 other states that Ohio kind of forced the hand to take the official nominating process out of the in-person convention?
Well, I think delegates understand that Ohio is a special case in American politics right now. But, you know, we saw what the DNC did in 2020 when they did a virtual, you know, components of their convention, which was, you know, they did little mini celebrations of each state as it announced its vote totals, you know, for the presidential nomination. And I would look to see something very similar, where every state is going to have that moment where they're going to put forward, you know, their symbols, their sort of little mini celebration, even if it's only for a few seconds of their state's, you know, background.
How do you feel that this whole situation made Ohio look in the eyes of the political world around the rest of the country, that this couldn't be fixed quickly and easily?
Well, you know, at this point in the Ohio legislature, they would have trouble organizing a two-car funeral procession. So it looks like a dysfunctional group. And here's the real, you know, problem for the Ohio legislature. Alabama had the exact same problem, literally the exact same problem. Their legislature quickly dispensed with it and unanimously approved an exemption for 2024 to put President Biden on the ballot. So Alabama was capable of doing this. Ohio wasn't. You know, back in the day in Alabama, they used to say, well, thank God for Mississippi, anytime somebody said something bad about Alabama. And now the problem is states can say thank God for Ohio, because relative to Ohio, their legislatures are functioning.
So looking ahead now to November 5th, regardless of what the sentence is for the former president, do you still expect Trump to win Ohio fairly easily? I believe it was, what, 8 points
right.
4 years ago.
The short answer is yes. The demographics of Ohio are very favorable to the Republican Party right now. And so, you know, Biden is probably in 2020 as strong a candidate as the Democrats could have put up for Ohio, and it didn't matter. You know, it did not close the gap from 2016. You know, Ohio as a whole, you know, the demographics, it's whiter than the nation. It's older than the nation. It is, you know, has a lower college education rate than the nation. You know, that's pretty well a description of a Trump base, and it's, you know, a Trump-based state at this point.
You kind of touched on it at the beginning when you were talking about unprecedented, but is this one of those moments where all of these things coming together, in particular with the Trump criminal trial conviction, where you just say, you know, we've never seen anything like this, and we likely won't see anything like it again, right in the middle of a campaign especially?
Well, one can certainly hope. But you do look at the totality of what's happening in our presidential election and these events, and you say, if you wrote this, if this was a West Wing plot, you wouldn't believe it. You know, if you wrote this, you know, 10 years ago, this, you know, this would lack credibility. But it's what we're in the midst of, and, you know, it's what Americans, you know, are having to wade through on a daily basis. You know, I think this invigorates, you know, what's his, you know, rally theme going forward. You know, it's been the 2020 election for a very long time, and a lot of Republican, you know, pundits are very concerned about that he's too far looking in the past. And so this at least gives him, a new line of attack to say, you know, that this court case was rigged against him, which, you know, he was already saying. He's, you know, his allies were saying it within seconds of the verdict. So it does give him some new material. And, you know, if you watch a Trump rally, they go on and on and on forever. So he can always use some new material.
Dr. David Niven with the University of Cincinnati, thank you so much for your perspective today. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Now here's a look at the important dates for the general election. Election day is November 5th. However, military and overseas absentee voting starts September 20th. The deadline for you to register to vote is October 7th, and early voting starts the very next day. Of course, we're still several months away, so don't worry. As we get closer, we'll remind you of these deadlines.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
The war on drugs in Ohio took center stage. This summit was hosted by the Ohio Narcotics Intelligence Center, or ONIC for short. It brought together law enforcement, crime lab specialists, and drug task forces to learn about the latest trends. It's a battle Ohio's top leaders say evolves every day.
These criminal elements and cartels are using technology. They're using social media tools to market their wares, to connect to customers, to keep out of the eyes of law enforcement. And so we need to use technology to continue to try to monitor and find where the drugs are coming from.
10TV is uncovering a new zombie street drug now infiltrating Ohio's borders. It's already shown up in 8 states and is blamed for overdose deaths in several cities. An alert just released from the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education shows this sedative is more deadly than xylazine. It's called medetomidine, a powerful animal tranquilizer used on dogs and cats. But experts at ONIC say drug dealers are mixing the sedative with fentanyl and other street drugs to create a deadly cocktail.
However, if a sedative like metomidine is present, that can complicate the life-saving or the use of naloxone, because metomidine is a sedative and it's not an opioid, so it's not responsive to naloxone.
Ohio is taking another step toward recreational marijuana sales. New rules are now officially in effect for businesses applying for recreational marijuana licenses. Meanwhile, 10TV's Tara Jabor is hearing from local dispensary owners who say all that's holding them back is that license.
Recreational marijuana is coming soon to downtown Columbus.
I think that
a lot of people are chomping at the bit.
It's 2024. Like, people should be able to do what they want to do.
Ohio voted yes for recreational marijuana back in November, and some people say it's taken the state a while to get things rolling.
Everyone I know that has been going elsewhere if they can't get it here.
Medical dispensaries will be able to apply for a recreational license starting June 7th. Jason Erks with Sunnyside Dispensary says they've been preparing for an influx of sales.
We're hiring additional staff. We're optimizing traffic flow in the store, making sure that we'll have enough product when things are ready to launch.
Sunnyside has three locations in central Ohio, Newark, Chillicothe, and Marion. Erks says he hopes to start recreational sales ASAP.
Actually ahead of schedule. So at the end of next week, the state will open up the application process for us to be able to apply. They'll be approving them as they are submitted.
The Ohio Chamber of Commerce is one of the groups who is outspoken about not wanting recreational sales. Rick Carfagna with the chamber says they have a lot of questions for bars and restaurants that have customers who may want to smoke marijuana at their establishments.
It's still a controlled substance under federal law, and the Division of Liquor Control has already warned businesses that they could be jeopardizing their liquor permits by allowing use on their premises.
Carfagna says they also want to see the tax dollars from recreational marijuana be put towards any potential issues that arise with recreational usage.
You know, that's making sure that we have money diverted to law enforcement and that we have money diverted to behavioral health and recovery services.
That was Tara Jabor reporting. The state of Ohio also announced a model policy for school districts to follow when it comes to banning cell phones in schools. The policy prohibits students from using phones or similar electronic devices on school property during school hours. It also requires students to keep their phones in a secure place, such as a locker, a backpack, or a storage area provided by the district. Districts can create their own policy. They have until next July, 2025, to figure out a plan. Nearly $29.5 million is now going toward improving housing access in Ohio. The funding is part of the first round of the Welcome Home Ohio program. It will help land banks buy, rehabilitate, or build properties for income-eligible Ohioans. Here in central Ohio, Marion County is receiving about $30,000 for a property.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
We end today with the story of Dr. Wawei Li. His name is likely unfamiliar to most, but as 10 TV's Angela Ann shares, what Dr. Li created during his time at Ohio University is being used by millions.
Just a few miles north of Ohio University in Athens, many have wondered why two marble Chinese lions grace the entrance of this brick building. This is why.
So the Wawei Li Annex is one of five depositories in the state. And Wawei Li made sure that we had a depository here in Southeast Ohio, which was a huge accomplishment.
Janet Holmes says that's just a snippet of the contributions from the man who came before her. In 1978, Dr. Wawei Li started a two-decade tenure as dean of university libraries. The Chinese-American turned OU into one of the top 100 academic research libraries in North America. He also created Ohio Link, basically modernizing the days of card catalogs into a massive online library sharing system. It is still being used today throughout the Buckeye State.
A user can easily request an item from another library. That library will respond and ship that material to the next or to the requester, right, and they get it within, you know, days.
I'm the youngest of six children.
For Bob Lee, the man described as patient, warm, and humble was simply dad.
It wasn't until, much later in my life that I realized what an impact he was making and how well known he was all around the world.
Yeah. Like the time his father was given the Melville Dewey Medal Award, the highest achievement for any librarian.
Well, I think it's safe to say, like, from the 60s up and through the 90s, you know, he was the preeminent Asian librarian in the Western world.
Dr. Lee passed away in December, but his footprints can be felt on five continents, where he gave lectures, presentations, and workshops, all while building a new generation of library leaders.
He had established at Ohio University an exchange program, so many, many librarians from the East came through that program and even lived at our house sometimes. We had lots of parties where they all came over to our house, and then they all went out into the world and, you know, lead libraries themselves now.
When Dr. Lee retired from OU, it wasn't long. In 2003, the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. asked Lee to serve as the Asian Division Chief, the highest leadership position of any Asian American librarian.
He started to give them some names of people he thought would be good, and they're like, no, Dr. Lee, we want you to be the head of the Asian Division. So he became the first Asian to be the head of the Asian Division of the Library of Congress.
A far cry from when Dr. Lee first came to America after fleeing communist China.
I mean, he had nothing. I think he arrived with, you know, one suitcase and a few hundred dollars in his pocket and, you know, just scrapped for everything that he could get.
Dr. Lee's legacy will likely one day join the depository annex that bears his name, a story so unique and worth preserving.
And Dr. Lee had many other achievements, including helping OU become a member of the prestigious Association of Research Libraries. You can read more about his life and legacy on 10TV.com.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.